Hello, fellow fiends. Welcome to another episode of Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces. I am your host, Cassie Opea. Don't forget, you can find me every Friday with brand new episodes of the creepiest and spookiest content on your favorite podcast platform and now YouTube. Also, if you subscribe to the Patreon page or the Anchor page through Spotify, you get bonus episodes every other Tuesday, a merchandise discount, which is good on everything, in the Wick and Fae shop at pizzaandpigtails.com. It's good for every purchase, not just a one time. So definitely buy into that. That pays for itself. And I know that sometimes you kind of want to help support your friends or your favorite content creators. And sometimes the budget just doesn't allow you to subscribe. So if you want to support without subscribing, I do have a Cash App and a Venmo. And don't feel bad. Every little bit helps and every little bit is appreciated. Also, liking, sharing, commenting, following on social media, that also is a great way to support without subscribing to a monthly fee. So definitely do that. Share with your fellow fiends, get them in on the conversation, get them in on listening, get them in on watching, buying merchandise and the candles at the Wick and Fae shop. That definitely also helps the podcast, and it definitely helps bring more and more content. And if you are a small business owner or a big business owner, I do have ad space available. So definitely reach out and I can send you my budget-friendly packages. So today's episode, it's actually quite disturbing. There are some grisly details, and they include the assault and murder of young children. So if that's not something you want to hear about, or if you have little ears in the vicinity, I'd say maybe don't listen to this episode, and or maybe listen to this episode a little later on when those little ears aren't around. This is also one of those cases that made me very angry. It actually made me more and more angry the further down the rabbit hole I fell. It actually took me a while to research this case because I would get so frustrated and mad and I don't want to say emotional, but I guess emotional. So I would have to keep taking breaks and I'd have to distract myself with something. So there was a lot of games played, a lot of ASMR videos to help me, you know, get back to my zen during this. But on May 5th, 1993, around 6:30 p.m., 8-year-old Stevie Branch, 8-year-old Chris Byers, and 8-year-old Michael Moore, three best friends who were wolves in the local Cub Scout pack together, are seen riding their bikes through their neighborhood in West Memphis, Arkansas. Later on that evening, police receive a phone call reporting that Chris Byers is missing. And it wasn't long after this, only about an hour and a half, when Michael Moore and Stevie Branch are also reported missing. A massive search is put together by neighbors, friends, and family, but the boys are nowhere to be found. The next morning, May 6th, around 1:45 p.m., I guess that's not really the morning, their bicycles are found near a water pipe, while their bodies are found in a part of the woods called Robin Hood Hills. The boys were nude, hog-tied, and mutilated, and their clothes were jammed into the mud floor with sticks. Three local teens, Damian Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miss Kelly Jr., were arrested, charged, and convicted of the crimes. Now, holding tight to their innocence, they were still sent to prison for what was believed to be a satanic ritual killing. This set off a massive firestorm that spawned books, movies, and television documentaries about this case. For 30 years, the full details, are still uncleared as to what happened that evening. Now, with new evidence being brought to light, proving the three teenagers were wrongfully convicted, they were finally set free in 2011 after spending 18 years of their life in prison. Now, two tragedies wrapped up together. These are the creepy cases of the West Memphis Three and the Robin Hood Hills murders. November 28, 1984, usually referred to as Stevie, was a second grader at Weaver Elementary School in West Memphis, Arkansas. He was known for his friendly demeanor, loved by his classmates, and an honor student. His parents, Stephen Branch Sr. and Pamela Hicks Hobbs, divorced when he was a baby, so Stevie lived with his mother and stepfather, Terry Hobbs, and his younger sister, Amanda. He had light blonde hair, he was 4'2" and weighed around 65 pounds. Now, his grandfather, Jackie Hicks Sr., had recently given him a brand new bicycle. On May 5th, 1993, Stevie was walked home from school by his mother and younger sister, and Pam was actually supposed to work the dinner shift at a local restaurant named Catfish Island that evening. She told Stevie he could ride bikes with his friend Michael Moore until 4:30. However, he didn't make it home by the time Pamela went to work. Stevie was last seen around 6:30 p.m. wearing blue jeans, a white t-shirt, and riding a red and black bicycle. Christopher Mark Byers, known to his family and friends as Chris, was born June 3, 1984. Now, his parents, Sharon Melissa Byers, and his father, Rick Mary, divorced when he was only 4 years old, and he lived with his mother and his stepfather, John Mark Byers, who adopted him, and he also had a half-brother named Sean Ryan Clark. Now, he was also a second grader at Weaver Elementary, and he had recently friended Michael Moore and Stevie Branch. Chris was 4 feet tall, about 52 pounds, and had light brown hair. Chris had a hyperactive disorder, and he was medicated, but his behavior wasn't really improving. Now, on May 5th, around 3:30, he showed up at the Hobbs home looking for Stevie. Now, since Stevie had already left with Mike to ride bikes, Chris stayed to watch an episode of Muppet Babies with Amanda, and he left around 4 p.m. Now, multiple people saw him with Stevie and Michael before he was picked up by his father and taken home to clean the carport. He was left at home with Melissa while John went to pick up his older brother, and Melissa said she last saw him around 5:45 cleaning the carport before he left to meet up with Stevie and Mike. Now, he was last known to be seen by Chris Wall around 6:30, wearing blue jeans, dark shoes, and a white long-sleeved t-shirt. Now, James Michael Moore, known as Mike, was born July 27, 1984, also a second grader at Weaver Elementary, just like the other two boys. He lived with his mother, Diana Dana Moore, and Todd Moore, and he had a sister named Dawn. Now, he's described as a natural-born leader who enjoyed participating in Cub Scouts and pretending to be in law enforcement. Mike was 4'2", 55 pounds with brown hair. On May 5th, he went over to Stevie's house so the two could go ride bikes. They were supposed to be back by 4:30, but Pam Hobbs said that they hadn't returned by the time she left for her serving shift at 5 p.m. Now, the two boys were seen by multiple neighbors in the area. Different sightings and different times, kind of. There's a little bit of conflict there. But the last known sighting of Mike actually differs from Stevie and Chris, because Chris Wall didn't report seeing him like he did the other two. He was on a light green bicycle, and he was wearing blue pants, a blue Boy Scout of America shirt, and an orange and blue Boy Scout hat. Now, Brian Woody is the last known person to see Mike officially, but his observation has been questioned because he states that Mike was in a vehicle quite a distance from where the boys were when he saw them going into the woods. May 5th, around 7 p.m., John Mark Byers called police to report his stepson, Chris, missing. He was last seen by his mother around 5:45 out in the yard. It wasn't too long after when the parents of Michael Moore and Stevie Branch also called to report their children missing. News of the missing boys spread, leading to a frantic search by friends and neighbors in an area called Robin Hood Hills, where the children played near I-40. Now, sadly, nothing turned up, and some of them stayed out until 3 in the morning. Now, around 6:30 the following morning, May 6, Mark Byers went with Denver Reed from the Crittenden County Search and Rescue, and around 8 a.m., Chief Inspector Gary Gitchell began to search while waiting for the rest of the team. Now, the search came to a close around 1:45 p.m. when juvenile parole officer Steve Jones spotted a black shoe floating in a muddy ditch that led to a major drainage canal in Robin Hood Hills that ran into the 10-mile bayou. Now, one source reported that in an attempt to receive the shoe, Sergeant Mike Allen, the name kind of interchanges, slipped and fell into the water, revealing the body of Michael Moore. He was nude, hogtied, and had multiple injuries to his body. As the police put the yellow crime scene tape up around the area, the bodies of Christopher Byers and Steve Branch were found. Like Michael, their bodies were submerged, naked and covered in injuries, and hogtied in an odd way. The tie used were the boys' own shoelaces, but instead of being tied like the hogtied, the right wrist was tied to the right ankle and the left wrist was tied to the left ankle, which actually left quite a bit of slack in the tie. Their clothing was found in the creek, and some of it was twisted around sticks that had been shoved into the muddy bed of the ditch, so it looked like somebody was trying to keep the clothes down and hidden. The clothing was mostly inside out, and two pairs of the boys' underwear were never found. All three boys had extensive injuries, including bruises and lacerations, and Chris's included mutilation to his genitals to the point of castration. Now, later testimony said it was due to animal predation. However, since no one knows for sure what happened, this hasn't been proven. And the three bodies were removed from the water and placed on a narrow area beside the ditch. And Crittenden County Coroner Ken Hale arrived several hours later and pronounced the boys deceased. Inspector Gary Gitchell walked to the edge of the woods where a large crowd had gathered with the unfortunate task of reporting the news to the families. Upon hearing this, Terry Hobbs, Stevie's stepfather, collapsed to the ground and began weeping. Now, Dr. Frank J. Peretti, a forensic pathologist, performed autopsies on the three young boys, reporting Chris died of multiple injuries, while Mike and Stevie died of multiple injuries and drowning, as they had water in their lungs. Now, the injuries included facial contusions to the lips, ear fractures, fractures at the base of the skull, neck abrasions, defensive wounds, and the lacerations were performed with a knife that had a serrated blade, but no knives or weapons were found at the crime scene. Now, police initially suspected that the boys had been sexually assaulted due to trace amounts of semen, but later testimony kind of disputed this. Also, they said that when a body, that there was anal dilation, but when a body dies, this is actually normal to happen. So, we're not quite sure if there was assault or not, but he placed their death between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. Now, despite the violence level of the crime, there was very little evidence at the scene. There was a lack of blood. The only blood was actually found on the bodies and the bank when they were removed, and there was a fiber that also was there, and the area kind of looked as though it had been swept clean. Now, Stephen Michael's bikes were found in the water by a pipe not too far from the bodies, and a shoe print was also found nearby, while a flat bank had been pushed down, and there was mud on the grass. Now, the sticks that were holding the clothes weren't collected for 6 months, which makes me wonder, like, why were they not collected immediately? But also, were they even the same sticks that were found holding the clothes? Like, how do we even know that they were the same sticks that were there? And of course, the police struggled to build the case because there was no evidence and no motive could be thought of. I mean, why on earth would anyone just out of the blue murder 3 8-year-old boys so violently? Well, that is until Lieutenant Sudbury spoke to Crittenden County Juvenile Officer Steve Jones, who pointed out that he felt the murders had a strong undertone of an occult sacrifice. Basically, basing his opinion on the state of the bodies, that they were in the woods, they were nude, and one of them was castrated. Now, I don't know very much about occult sacrifice, just what I've, you know, kind of read in books or seen in the movies or on TV, but I don't know if an occult sacrifice would then lead somebody to hide the bodies. Usually those are laid out for, you know, viewing or for to visual. But this, of course, spread like wildfire that the killings might have been done by devil worshippers, and it immediately gained national attention. Now, instead of telling the community that it was just a possibility at this time and that the rumors were connected with activities by devil worshippers, Gitchell basically said that they were looking for, you know, Satanists. And this overshadowed everything else. So, with this suspicion, panic soon swept through the community and fell on 3 West Memphis teenagers. 18-year-old Damian Eccles, a high school dropout and a Wiccan who denied being interested in Satanism, and a troublemaker. Now, of course, I'm not calling Wiccans troublemakers, as a witchy woman myself. He was just known in the area as being a troublemaker, so I figured I would throw that in there. He also had a history of mental issues, including delusions, auditory and visual hallucinations. He had a disordered thought process and chronic mood swings. He denied knowing the boys or being involved in their death. Now, 17-year-old Jason Baldwin, a friend of Eccles, they were both kind of social outcasts. Now, Baldwin was a decent student, and he wasn't involved in Eccles' experimentation with magic. Despite their differing personalities, they spent a lot of time with one another. The 16-year-old, Jesse Miss Kelly Jr., was also speculated as a suspect. He didn't really know Damien or Jason well, but just knew him from around school. Now, all three had had run-ins with authority, mostly fighting, vandalism, shoplifting, and they were also seen as more outliers and were targeted as they dressed in black, had long hair, and listened to heavy metal music. Now, in Arkansas at this time, being different somehow went hand in hand with being weird, a freak, or a criminal. Police focused on these three boys. Damien was claimed to be the leader, while Jesse and Jason were his faithful followers, and so they charged full speed ahead with their investigation. Now, there were a couple of other suspicious people in the community that were kind of looked at. Chris Morgan and Brian Holland were briefly on the list. Both had drug offenses and left quickly after the bodies were discovered. But they claimed not to know the boys as well. Morgan had an ice cream truck route through the neighborhood, but that was about it. May 17th, he was interviewed by police. They were given a polygraph, and they claimed that there was deception upon denial. Now, Chris Morgan claimed that he had a history with drug and alcohol and often had memory lapses and blackouts. He said that he might have committed the murders, but he quickly recanted this. Blood and urine samples were taken and sent off, but there was no real indication that they were ever actually investigated. The relevance that he recanted his statement was eventually barred from any evidence. And I find it to be kind of weird that, like, they interviewed these teenagers and just took them at their word that they weren't involved. These teenagers, they were like, oh, you're lying. And these teenagers have deception in their polygraphs, while these don't. So, just pointing that out. So, there was also a man that they named Mr. Bojangles. He was an unknown black male who was implied as a possible suspect at Jesse's trial. Not Jerry. I don't know who Jerry is. But he was implied at Jesse's trial as a possible suspect. Now, May 5th, around 8:42 p.m., employees in a restaurant about a mile from the crime scene reported seeing a black male who seemed mentally disoriented inside the ladies' room. Now, the man had blood on him, but they couldn't tell if he was bleeding or if it was somebody else's blood that he was just kind of covered in. And he had been rubbing up against the bathroom walls. Now, Officer Regina Meeks responded to the call, and I have to say that this kind of makes me laugh, but also kind of irks me, because she took the report from the manager through the restaurant's drive-through window. She didn't even get out of her car to walk in to investigate the issue. Now, of course, the man was already gone by this time, so, you know, but I mean, how are you even investigating when you don't even go in to see the actual spot where the man was? Now, on May 7th, the day after the bodies were found, manager Marty King thought that there was a possible connection. So he actually called to report to police again. And this is when they finally went to the restaurant and inspected the bathroom. Now, the unknown man reportedly had a blue brace on his arm that had white Velcro. And of course, this would have made it kind of difficult to perform the acts against the young boys, but how do we know that this brace or cast or whatever was real? Or was it just something he was wearing, or, you know, just to, for not looks, but like sympathy, or, you know, Ted Bundy used to wear a cast and ask women for help. And we all know that story. Now, King gave the police sunglasses that he believed the man left behind, and they took the blood samples from the wall, which 2 days later, why was this not cleaned up? Like, I get it's like a crime scene and everything like that. Well, not even a crime scene, no crime was committed, but it's suspicious. But also, why did you not clean the blood off the walls after 2 days? Just wondering. But, you know, then again, Detective Bryn Ridge testified that he actually lost those blood samples. So, good God, these people. Now, a hair belonging to a black male was actually found on one of the sheets that the bodies had been wrapped in. Now, Steve, the parole officer, felt Damien was capable of murdering children. And I always say that if you feel like something is off or something feels off about somebody, it most likely is. However, I don't see how you can base an entire murder case off of that feeling. Between May 7th and May 10th, investigators questioned Damien twice at his house and once at the police station. Now, when he was at the police station, they actually gave him like a written out questionnaire with questions like, did you know the boys? He said he'd never heard of them. What should happen to the person who did this? Do you believe they should get a second chance? Now, he said that if the person did it just for fun, they should be sentenced to death. But if they have like a mental problem, they should be locked up and possibly get a second chance. More questions were, why would someone do this? And he said, maybe they're sick or psychotic. And they asked, who do you think did this? And he gave a few names, not really like saying they did it, but, you know, saying maybe you should look into these people. Are you familiar with the area? And I think he put that he had never been in the woods. His responses were also written out, and I was looking at a photo, which wasn't the greatest quality, so I couldn't really read what that line said. So I'm not sure if he said that he had never been in the woods or if he had never been in that part of the woods before. But then they asked, why would your prints be at the scene of the crime? And he claims they won't be. And I feel like this is a trick, and I've seen it happen in a lot of, like I said, I watch a lot of TV shows and documentaries on true crime. And I always feel like they always try to like trip you up. But I also feel like if you're in a public place, there's going to be so much DNA from all kinds of people. And it's just one of those things where it's like, it's a public place. You can't always take the DNA that is found. But you still have to like connect it with the crime or the body or whatever happened. Although Damien denied any involvement and even knowing the boys, and he had an alibi, which he was at somebody's house during the day that his mom dropped him off with his girlfriend, and then his mom picked him up and took him home where he was, and he was actually on the phone until around 11:30 that night with his girlfriend. So why don't you pull the records? He was there with his mother. He has multiple people who said they knew where he was. And he found out about the kids being murdered at Lakeshore Park from Jason and his mother. Yet, police still focused on him. Now, Lieutenant James Sudbury wrote in the notes of Damien's interview that the killer is probably someone local and that he won't run. He also noted that Damien likes to read books by Stephen King, and if that makes you a suspect or suspicious to commit murder, I'm in a lot of trouble because I absolutely love Stephen King, and I have read just about every book he's put out. Not every book, but just about. But they also pointed out that Damien had the word evil tattooed across his knuckles, and he was given a polygraph, which they claim was full of deception. However, how do we know that it actually was? Jason Baldwin also had evil tattooed across his fingers, and he denied knowing the boys as well, but police didn't believe him. Now, Jason was actually interviewed without parental consent, and his mother returned and told the police to leave him alone. And they pushed to be able to interview him, but they had already overstepped their boundaries, and she said, you know, basically get out, which I don't blame her. On May 9th, Damien mentioned that one of the victims had wounds to his genitals, and they said that this was basically something that incriminated him. But once again, this was reported, and basically the entire town, or, you know, whoever had read about the case, knew about it. So I don't see how this could be an incriminating factor. Police kept the trio in their sights, and soon Vicky Hutchison enters the picture. Now, on May 6th, in an interview totally unrelated, before the boys' bodies were even found, Vicky was actually being given a polygraph by Don Bray to determine if she had stolen money from her employer. And I just have to say that this town really relies on those polygraphs, but I find it odd that they all always have deception in them. Now, her 8-year-old son, Aaron, who is actually friends with the three boys who were murdered, was present, and he was being so distracting that they couldn't administer the rest of the polygraph test. And I feel like this is just a little inconvenient, but that's just me. Now, Aaron told Bray that the boys had actually been killed at the playhouse that they had played in the woods, where they would watch men do nasty stuff. Now, I'm not even sure how they got on to the topic of the boys, because this was just weird timing. But the bodies were near where Aaron had said, okay, but Brady called upon Aaron for more details, and he told him that Satanists who spoke Spanish killed his friends, but the rest of his claims were wildly inconsistent. I mean, he's 8. Now, he was also unable to identify Damien, Jason, and Jesse in a lineup, and there was no playhouse at the location. And I feel like if you watched somebody murder your friends, even as an 8-year-old, you're going to be able to point those people out. Now, Vicky told law enforcement that she was willing to play detective and assist them in their investigation. Law enforcement encouraged her to enlist Jesse, who had actually babysit for her and mowed her lawn quite a few times. Now, Vicky asked Jesse to introduce her to Damien, who had told her, well, Jesse told her that Damien had drank blood and stuff. I do want to point out that Jesse only had an IQ of about 72 and was known to be a little on the learning disabled side. She told him that she was interested in going out with Damien, so Jesse agreed and shortly brought Damien over to introduce the two. She had microphones in her home, but the recordings were considered to be inaudible. And police say they were inaudible. She says they were audible, but she also stated that there wasn't really anything incriminating stated between the two. Now, exact details between Vicky and Damien never really came to light, but at the time she hatched quite the story for police. On the night of May 19th, she claims that her and Jesse were driven by Damien in a red Ford Escort. Now, this is odd because Damien didn't have a car and had never been known to drive one. Now, yes, you can borrow cars. However, this kid was never known to drive. And they went to an Esbat. Now, an Esbat is a gathering of witches. Many different things happen there. A lot of it is just basically getting out with nature and maybe doing some meditating, some manifesting, things like that. But she says this was in a field outside of town where there were about 10 to 15 people, all underage, she believed they were all underage anyway, with their faces and arms painted black, stripping off their clothes and touching each other. She didn't really get into details about that, but she did say that this was when a drunk Damien openly bragged about killing the children. She said that those who were participating in the orgy used names like Spider, Snake, and Lucifer, and she was offended by the nudity, so she asked to be taken home. And this is when Damien and her left, but Jesse stayed. Aaron told police that they saw five men in a circle chanting and doing what men and ladies do. The next day, June 3rd, 9 a.m., 17-year-old Jesse Miss Kelly is told that there is a $35,000 reward for information on an arrest for the murders, and that his family would be eligible if he had any information. Shockingly, he's given a polygraph test, but he denies any satanic rituals and murders. And the police tell him that he's lying his ass off. But of course, Jesse held on to that innocence. He didn't kill the boys. He was in another town watching a wrestling match where he was seen by multiple people who have corroborated this as truth. Police question him for a harsh 12 hours. And guess what? Some of that was recorded. A whole 46 minutes of that 12 hours. Conveniently, the 46 minutes where he's confessing are the only ones that they recorded. Now, this is also where I always say, ask for a lawyer. Even if you're innocent, you know you have nothing to hide, you know you didn't do anything wrong, police will try to intimidate you and they will try, you know, don't do it. If you get a lawyer, it just makes you look guilty. But they're going to twist your words, and it's, you just always ask for a lawyer. Always. Sorry. Now, after hours of being yelled at, threatened, intimidated, starved, and I'm sure this poor boy was exhausted, Jesse was coerced into confessing to police. However, his story had many inconsistencies with the crime scene and the murders in general. He also contradicted himself multiple times. Jesse claimed the police would ask him questions like, were the boys tied up? Well, this was common knowledge, so of course he'd say yes, right? But then they'd ask, what were they tied up with? He'd say rope, and that's when the detective would yell at him, and he would change it to shoestrings, which was also common knowledge. They asked, what were the boys wearing? Well, they were naked. I mean, I know that they were clothed before their clothes were removed, but in the long run, they were naked. Now, Jesse says that he went over the story over and over until it was right for police. He said that they would feed him information, and he just kind of formed a story. It shaped into May 5th, 1993. Jesse received a call from Jason Baldwin asking him to go to West Memphis with Damien and himself. Jesse said no because he had to work, but ended up going with them anyway. He says at 9 a.m., they walked to Robin Hood Woods, where Damien hit one boy real bad and started screwing him and stuff. You can hear the officer say which one and showed him a picture of the boys. And Jesse says, Michael Moore. And an officer says, that boy you're pointing to is the buyer's boy. And Jesse says, mm-hmm. So you're not even pointing at the right kid. Now, I know you may not know their names and things like that, but come on now. So he says that Jason hit Steve Branch with his fist and bruised him. He said Michael ran. He chased him and brought him back, and when the other guys got to him, he left. But then he said that he went back, and that was the boys were naked and tied up, and he said that their hands were tied together. He said that Damien and Jason started screwing the boys, so he took off and went home. Later on, they called and asked him why he didn't stay, and he said, "I just couldn't." Now, if I know there's been a lot thrown at you, but if you're kind of keeping track, there were a lot of inconsistencies. The time of the murders took place, the time they entered the woods, what they were tied up with, what they were attacked and assaulted with, how they were tied up, that they were sexually assaulted, that they were choked. I mean, come on. How anyone could actually allow this to be admissible, or how they could allow this to be, or just even believing and taking this as what happened, when it goes against everything we know. Now, it's also been said that Jesse didn't understand his Miranda rights when they were read to him. But of course, the police say he definitely did. He recanted his statement immediately, saying that he was just trying to cooperate because he just wanted to go home and he was terrified of police. Also, keep in mind, his parents weren't present. He had no lawyer, and his parents didn't even know that he was being questioned. And that right there should be means to throw that shit out anyway. Now, although there was no physical evidence, and the three boys had alibis, which multiple people placed them in different areas away from the woods, by 10:30 p.m. on June 3rd, Damien Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse McKelley Jr. had been arrested, and they stayed in custody while the prosecuting and defense teams began prepping for trial. Now, during this time, while collecting evidence, a knife that John Mark Byers, Chris Byers' stepfather, owned, tested positive for blood. Blood that was determined to be consistent with Chris Byers' blood. Did they pursue this lead? Of course not. Which I have to say, what the f***? They re-interviewed 8-year-old Aaron, because why wouldn't we? And his story changed again. Now, he claims the night before the murders, he received a call from Jesse asking him to bring his three friends to the woods where they would all do something. Okay. Now, I get that, like, Jesse has babysat Aaron before, and he knows him, and he's friends with his mom, but I don't see why he would just call him out of the blue, an 8-year-old child, to go hang out with each other the next day in the woods. And then bring your three friends, because, yeah, that's normal, right? Now, he said that once they were there, Jesse, Jason, and Damien slapped his friends. He said that he ran and Jesse caught him, but he got away and he caught him again and tied him up. He said he stayed there for about 40 seconds and he got untied. How? He said that he was tied up with rope, but they couldn't hurt him because he kicked them all with a foot. He said that his friends got stabbed and their clothes had been pulled off of them. He said that the one had his private part cut off, and he watched the three teens sexually assault the boys. I just don't even know. Now, Hutchison later claims that she couldn't recall the night of the gathering, and she only implicated Damien and Jesse to avoid criminal charges in her theft case and to obtain the reward money. Now, they knew what Aaron claimed happened was wildly implausible. However, Gary Gitchell was pleased to have a second witness to the crime. And this dude is just, shit-ass detective. Or he was, if he's not doing it anymore. But I don't get it. Now, because Jesse confessed on August 4th, 1993, Judge David Burnett ruled that he would be tried separately and Damien and Jason would be tried together. He also ruled that his confession could be used, even though it was obtained under coercive circumstances. Officers repeatedly refused to believe him when he denied involvement. They actually showed Jesse a circle diagram telling him he could be inside the circle with the killers or outside the circle with the police. And they also played a recording of Aaron's voice saying, "Nobody knows what happened but me." I just don't get it. Now, Burnett also ruled all three teens would be tried as adults. Each teenager was charged with three counts of murder, and all pleaded not guilty. Now, prosecutor John Fogelman wanted Jesse to testify against Damien and Jason, but he refused. And good for him. So on January 24th, 1994, the opening statements for Jesse's trial started. Fogelman claimed discrepancies were due to him just trying to downplay his role in the murders, and the proof will show that he was an accomplice. And what I love is the fact that they had absolutely no proof of anything. Just saying. Now, Dan Stidham, Jesse's attorney, said that police were under tremendous pressure to get someone for this case. They had tunnel vision from day one, and Jesse only confessed after interrogators broke his will and scared him beyond measure. Now, the state started off with a bang. Their first witnesses were the mothers of the murdered children. Each one went through the last time they saw their sons. Now, defense attorney Dan Stidham had suspicions that John Mark Byers had, husband to Melissa Byers and stepfather to Chris, was involved in the murders. But he actually refrained from pursuing this theory while cross-examining because he thought that he could possibly just make the jurors angry and they were going to naturally sympathize with the parents. Now, he laid out a graphic and disturbing journey while Detective Bryn Ridge testified his search for the boys and discovery of the bodies. Now, keep in mind, this is also the one who lost evidence. Now, as he talked about his experience, the bicycles of the 8-year-old boys were visible at the front of the courtroom. They introduced more than 30 photos of the boys, pale, bound, and mutilated, while Dr. Frank Peretti testified his autopsy report details. After Inspector Gary Gitchell took the stand, our favorite, right, to tell his side of Jesse's confession, he claimed that, yeah, Jesse was very relaxed during his long interrogation, and they had the jury listen to his taped confession, all 46 minutes of it. But during cross-exam, he basically said that Jesse's initial story contained multiple errors, but that it was just because Jesse simply got confused. That's all. Now, people expected to hear from little Aaron Hutchison, because, his testimony was a pretty big catalyst in this case. However, Fogelman knew that his story was just out there. And in my opinion, who knows if it would have even been the same story that he told before, because his story changed multiple times. Now, however, they did call upon Vicki Hutchison, and she said she offered her services to play detective because, quote, "I loved those boys and I wanted to see their killers caught," end quote. Now, she testified about the Judge Burnett ruling, but the painted faces, he claimed, and the orgy might be too prejudicial. So she basically only gave details of seeing 12 to 15 other young people in a field. During cross-exam, she denied that the $35,000 was a motive for her to do things like that. Or not do things like that, but to do what she did. Now, no physical evidence connecting Jesse to the crime. Fogel called Lisa Sekavicius from the state crime lab. She testified that a green polyester fiber found was microscopically similar to a fiber found on a shirt in Damien's house and a red fiber found near The crime scene was microscopically similar to a bathrobe in Jesse's house, and that it could have been, you know, through secondary transfer. Cross-exam, many fibers are microscopically similar, and this proves nothing. Now, Warren Holmes, a detective and polygraph examiner who actually worked on cases like Watergate, the JFK assassination, and the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination. Now, he says Jesse truthfully answered every single one of his questions except one, and that was about his prior drug use. It was the officer who lied to Jesse about his deception in an effort to scare him into a confession. And it worked, and he did, and here we are, sitting in a trial we shouldn't be in. Now, Dr. Richard Offshee claimed that police coercion during interrogation should have made Jesse's confession inadmissible. However, that pesky Judge Burnett allowed it. On February 4th, 1994, Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. is found guilty of first-degree and second-degree murder, and he is sentenced to life without parole. February 28, 1994, Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin's trial begins. Now, we all know that Jesse wouldn't testify. Jason's lawyers actually filed for the boys to be tried separately, but it was denied. They said that Damien was into witchcraft and Baldwin was just guilty of it by association. Police disregarded all statements and physical evidence, and they twisted and manipulated anything they could to fit their narrative. They targeted Damien because he wasn't your all-American boy. He was thought to be weird. However, there was still no evidence to link him to these murders. Damien and Jason were found guilty of capital murder. Jason was sentenced to life without parole, and Damien was sentenced to death. All three filed appeals, but their sentences and convictions were upheld. West Memphis could breathe a sigh of relief, right? Their town was safer. The case was solved. However, those outside of West Memphis felt that the boys had been unfairly targeted and convicted on flimsy evidence and falsehood, and I agree. Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam, Johnny Depp, and Henry Rollins, along with other celebrities, all started to voice the opinion and rally for these three boys. 1996, HBO actually put out Paradise Lost, the child murders at Robin Hood Hills, and this film started a movement. Also in 1996, there were apparently teeth impressions taken from Damien and Jason because there were marks found in one of the boys' heads, and none of those impressions matched. Now here's the thing. Why did we not do this in 1993? In the year 2000, Paradise Lost 2, Revelations, tried to name John Mark Byers as the real killer. A 1994 film called Devil's Knot focused on the misjustice that these boys went through. In 2003, Vicki Hutchinson admitted to lying about everything. She lied about going to the SBAT. She lied about Damien admitting to murdering the boys. She said she felt compelled to cooperate, thinking that they would take Aaron away from her. Now, Dawn Moore also claimed that she sent her daughter out to look for her son, Michael Moore, that day. However, her daughter claims that she didn't even see Michael at all that day, and her mom never sent her out. So someone here is lying. Now, in 2007, DNA found at the crime scene was retested and not matched to any of the teens. A hair in a knot that was on the hog tie was not inconsistent with Terry Hobbs, stepfather to Steve. Now, John Mark Byers then told reporters he believed Damien, Jason, and Jesse were all innocent after a lot of this evidence came to light. Now, even with this new evidence, Judge Burnett refused new trials, but the lawyers appealed and kept pushing. November 4th, 2010, the West Memphis Three finally got good news. They could reconsider newly discovered DNA evidence, evidence of juror misconduct in the original trials, and this justified a new trial, or at least an exoneration, which, you know, that's what we're hoping for. In 2012, the three men were offered a deal. They were told that if they pled the Alford plea, which is, if you remember from my episode on the staircase, it's when you plead guilty, but you maintain your innocence. Now, this was a deal that the state offered, and it would result in the release of the three. But all three of them had to agree to this, or none of them would be able to get it. In 2012, Damien actually wrote a book and talked about his experience while he waited for Jason, because he wanted to see if he would agree to this. Now, Jason actually, for lack of a better term, thrived in prison. He had a job, he was actually in school, and he had befriended the guards. Now, Damien had quite the opposite experience. Now, Jason agreed to the deal, and he actually said he didn't do it for himself, but he did it for Damien. August 19th, 2011, Judge David Lacer, thankfully replaced Judge Burnett, called what happened a tragedy on all sides. And on this day, Damien Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly Jr. walked free after 18 years in prison. A 2012 documentary called West of Memphis, paid for by director Peter Jackson, strongly pointed to Terry Hobbs and his friend David Jacoby. And they were hairs found at the scene, and they matched the men. Now, Terry Hobbs actually had a history of abuse towards his wife, child abuse, and assault on neighbors. Stevie Branch's aunt actually saw Hobbs doing laundry that evening. Now, I know that this isn't incriminating. Plenty of people do laundry at night. But could he have been washing mud off, hiding incriminating evidence? So, Stevie's prized knife was found in Terry Hobbs' possessions, which is a little odd, don't you think? Now, the three young men were actually told by Hobbs' nephew that he killed them, and it was a family secret. In 2013, Billy Wayne Stewart and Benny Guy signed affidavits, and this was separately, by the way, telling the details of what is most likely the truth, and it's actually highly credible. It reads, on May 5th, 1993, Terry Hobbs, David Jacoby, and two teens, L.G. Hollingsworth and Buddy Lucas, showed up at his house. This is Stewart. They were looking for pot, and he provided it. He noticed that Hobbs and Jacoby were kissing in his truck, and apparently Hobbs was bisexual, and would invite young children to pool parties, and Stewart would actually always make his son decline. Now, in April 1995, Lucas told Stewart that they drove around smoking pot and drinking whiskey before heading down a dirt road by Blue Beacon Wood. Lucas said that Hobbs asked the teenagers to get out and wrestle while he and Jacoby watched. Now, he didn't outright say that things had turned sexual, but the look on his face said it all. This is most likely when the boys came up on their bikes and just ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time. Terry Hobbs screamed, "Get them, little—" While Jacoby beat one of the kids, Hobbs ordered Buddy and LG to pull off his pants, repeatedly bit him and then cut the boy's genitals. This would have been Chris Byers. Hobbs announced the other two boys had to be killed because of what they had seen. Now, Hobbs and Jacoby did just that. The clothes and the bodies were gathered and dragged to the water while the bikes were thrown in the bayou. The affidavit was very similar from Benny Guy and described that Lucas and LG confessed to the killings, and it added that Hobbs became enraged after one of the boys had kicked him. At this point, he hit him in the head and said, "I'm going to teach your ass." Then the two men and the two teenagers began beating the boys to death. Now, what angers me is in 1995, Stewart actually tried to call Bill Sanders to tell him this. He wanted to, you know, report this then, and he never got back to him. And he basically doomed Damien, Jason, and Jesse. Now, Pam Hicks Hobbs, Terry's ex-wife, now ex-wife, and Stevie Branch's mother, is convinced that he killed her son, or was at least involved if he didn't do it all himself. She also said that he had this weird obsession with him, and it was almost an odd jealousy. Now, today, Damien Eccles is married and lives in Salem, Massachusetts, and continues to fight for his exoneration, which I honestly hope he achieves. Jesse, Miss Kelly, maintains a low profile. He still lives in West Memphis and is very reluctant to talk to the media. Jason Baldwin would actually like to work on behalf of the accused and attend law school. Now, I can't even imagine I can't even imagine just the tragedy of losing these three boys, but I also can't imagine losing 18 years of my life because of lazy police work, or police just being horrible at their jobs, or just vendettas too. And it's all of the above, and I'm pretty sure you can agree with what you've heard today. Now, the murders were a huge tragedy and never should have happened, but neither should sending three young teenagers to prison because they're different. And I really hope that people will start learning from the mistakes that have been made in the past. And on that note, I will see you next crime.
You've been listening to Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces, a Pizza and Pigtails production. Created and hosted by Cassie Opea. All episodes researched, written, and edited by yours truly. Don't forget, you can find new episodes of the creepiest and spookiest content every Friday on your favorite podcast listening platform, and now YouTube as well. Subscribe to the Patreon page or the anchor.fm page for as little as $5 a month for bonus episodes every other Tuesday, a merchandise discount, and a Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces thank you swag box. You can also support without subscribing through the Cash App and Venmo. Don't forget to follow along on social media, especially the Facebook and the Instagram page, at creepycases.spookyspaces for all future news and updates related to the podcast, and maybe see some content that's not featured here. Like, comment, and share with your fellow fiends to get that conversation started. And on that note, I'll see you next crime.